We're talking about COVID-19 and kids here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. So how is your child adjusting to wearing a mask to try to reduce transmission of COVID-19? With schools preparing to reopen some in-person learning in Wisconsin, parents have urgent questions about what can happen when children get the coronavirus and how best to protect them. What do you want to ask the pediatrician? Vaccinations, mask wearing, children's mental health, well-being? Phone lines are open at 800-642-1234. Dr. Raj Naik is a pediatrician at Gunderson Health System. He's on the board for the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and he's an expert in immunizations. Dr. Naik, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, and thank you for having me this morning.
So the statistics so far show that children tend to have lower rates of infection and that they have either mild symptoms or none at all. How does that inform the way you as a pediatrician look at COVID-19's effect on children?
Yes, I think it is becoming clear that children are at lower, and I think it's important to say lower and not no risk, from the infection itself, because there are some children that unfortunately end up with severe disease or a syndrome that happens after the infection called multi-inflammatory system or multi-inflammatory syndrome after the infection. But most children seem to handle the infection better, but that should not cover up the fact that children can suffer from the effects of this pandemic as a whole in other ways that may be less obvious to people, or you could even say hidden. And those consequences can be all of the downstream effects from the pandemic, from shutting down, from missed opportunities in school, from plunging vaccination rates, to food insecurity or mental health needs. So there's a lot of downstream effects that we can't ignore.
Have you seen children with symptoms in your office?
Yes, you know, there have been a number of patients of mine who have become infected. Most of them have been very minimally symptomatic, fortunately. I haven't had any of my own personal patients with severe disease to this point, so we've been fortunate, but it doesn't mean that we should rest on our laurels.
So with mild symptoms, what do you tell parents?
Yeah, with mild symptoms, the key, I think, for children is monitoring for more severe signs of illness, but also to make sure that the children, because they feel relatively well, are not serving as a source of spread of infection. And it is very challenging to quarantine or isolate a child. So there are some real unique consequences to keeping children and adolescents quarantined and isolated if they happen to be infected.
Yeah. What would you tell parents who are trying to reduce the spread, or parents who are welcoming that child back from in-person instruction in the afternoon? How do you handle that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of challenges related to children going back to school, how to keep them socially developing and involved while handling these unique problems related to the pandemic. And one thing we do know is that for older children, and for older children in terms of the pandemic, and mask wearing, we talk about two and up, where we think that it's safe to wear a mask. That, you know, wearing masks if you're not distanced is really important. I know there was an early narrative that it was unclear about whether or not masks can reduce the transmission and spread of infection, but I think scientifically that has been fully demonstrated now that wearing masks is important, and that's true of both children and adults, that if we're wearing masks, we can reduce transmission. So trying to encourage and model the mask wearing for children who are eligible to wear a mask, I think, is really important in decreasing transmission. You know, as kids transition back to activities in school in the future, it's certainly going to be important to demonstrate these principles of distancing and wearing masks.
We're talking with Dr. Raj Naik, a pediatrician at Gunderson Health System. What questions do you have for the pediatrician? Does your child go to a school that's opening up for in-person classes? What do you want to know about their risks? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Naik, you know, I can see it in my kids with sports canceled, not going to camps. You know, kids are not getting the same amount of exercise and fresh air. What effects would that have on your patients?
We are concerned about that, and it's a little bit easier now in the summer, and we would encourage, you know, children to be outside and participate in, you know, activities with their family or you know, small groups of other children if they're spaced and outside. We do know that outdoor risks are much less likely to result in transmission compared to indoor activities. But exercise is critical for children. There was a small study done in Italy that showed during the pandemic a significant change in behaviors that would be concerning for, you know, onset of obesity, including increased intake of junk food, decreased exercise, and increased screen time. And so at least while the weather's nice and we have the availability of the outdoors, we would strongly encourage parents to try to get their kids outside and doing outdoor activities in which they can exercise and trying to decrease the screen time. I think as the weather turns cold, it's going to be a lot more challenging.
I wonder if you spot a playground that doesn't have children on it, would you suggest that you use that playground equipment?
That's a good question, and I think that the important thing is good hand hygiene. So, can they use the equipment? I think they can, but what they should do is, clean their hands afterwards. So the hand sanitizers afterwards would be really important, hand washing when available. And, initially there were a lot more concerns about this so-called contact spread, which is touching surfaces. And although that certainly does play a role in transmission of infection, it seems to be that the more significant mode of spread is something we call droplet spread, which is these contact or with these respiratory droplets. And if you get into contact or close contact with those, that is a much more likely mode of transmission.
Okay, so certainly outdoors reduces risk of the spread as what you're seeing so far.
Yes, and it's been pretty well shown now that a majority of outbreaks occur in indoor settings. There was a study in China that looked at outbreaks defined as three or more cases in a group, and of 140-some outbreaks, only two were related to anything outdoors. So it certainly decreases the likelihood.
We're spending the hour with Gunderson Health System pediatrician Raj Naik. He's fielding your questions about kids and the coronavirus and other health issues affecting our little ones. How do you think the pandemic is affecting your child's health and well-being? Do you have questions about infant and child growth and development? Are you wondering about the inflammatory condition related to COVID in children? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Naik here on the Ideas Network. We're spending the hour on children's health and wellness amid the pandemic with a pediatrician as our guide here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A report released Friday by the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, it analyzed pediatric hospitalization data from 14 states It found that while hospitalization happens less often with children than adults, one in three hospitalized children was admitted to intensive care. How are you preparing for your child's school in the fall? Has your child had a checkup and kept up with their vaccinations amid the pandemic? What questions do you have about their growth and development? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. We have pediatrician Raj Naik, who is fielding our questions throughout the hour. Dr. Naik, in June, state health authorities said they were seeing a large decrease in childhood immunization. Some experts were worried about potential gaps. What are you seeing now?
Yes, this has actually been a really big concern. In fact, there's a lot of data about the plunging vaccination rates across the country. There's a national program called the Vaccine for Children program, which supplies immunizations across the country to children who might not otherwise have private insurance. And there were millions of doses less ordered across the country during the first few months of the pandemic. And that's a good proxy to know that the immunization rates are declining. And so I'm very concerned about the fact that we could have epidemics of vaccine-preventable diseases on top of this pandemic if we don't make sure our children are receiving their routine vaccinations.
What would you tell parents who are concerned about exposing themselves or their children to COVID-19 at a routine checkup where they would get a vaccine or multiple immunizations?
Yes, it's an excellent question. And I think early on, while the coronavirus pandemic was emerging, we had to learn how to keep environments safe, including the healthcare environment. But as we learned so much more about how this virus is spread, we have now done many things across the country, and certainly we're doing it at my organization, to decrease the likelihood of spread when you come into the healthcare organization. You know, we're using the protective equipment, we're sanitizing differently in many settings, we're keeping children who may have signs of illness away from children who do not, or other patients as well. There's screening at the doors of the organization. So I actually feel like coming into the healthcare center now may be one of the safer activities that you can do, and certainly indoors, because we're putting into place all these protocols to keep people safe. And so once we learned how to keep the environment safe, I think that it is really essential that children not only receive their routine vaccines, but their other screening services that they need and their routine health care, so that we can avoid these other hidden consequences of missed health care opportunities for children.
I wonder, you know, we've been with the virus for months now, and have the protocols for protective equipment and their use and the different protocols you're using at the office, has that changed much since the beginning?
It absolutely has changed. You know, in the beginning, we weren't sure, you know, which forms of spread were most important. So the roles of contact spread and so-called aerosolized spread. And when we talk about aerosolized spread, we're talking about things like measles, which can linger in the air for hours after the fact. We didn't know as much about those, and there's still some scientific debate about how much of this virus could be spread by aerosol, and there's that's not conclusively shown. But what we do know is the major form is this respiratory droplet spread. So as we learned about this, we learned about what equipment is most necessary in the setting. And what you'll see in most settings is typical droplet precautions, which mean a mask, and in the case of the medical provider, usually a face shield or eye protection. In some settings where it will cause more aerosol type things, like if they're receiving a breathing treatment or, you know, in the hospital setting where a breathing tube's being placed, then that's where you need these so-called N95 masks or other specific respiratory protective equipment.
We're talking with Dr. Raj Naik, a pediatrician expert in immunizations. You can join in with your questions. What do you wonder about the effects of the pandemic on your child's development? How have you seen the pandemic impact your child? Are you struggling to get your kids moving with sports or other activities canceled? We're at 800-642-1234 for your questions. Dr. Naik, I want to look at the social and mental health consequences on children to date. You know, as we limit our kids' contact, as they come in contact with masks and other face shields and PPE, how could that affect their development socially and emotionally?
Yes, it's also a really good point and another one of these downstream consequences. You know, the stress in general that some families and most families are experiencing can contribute to both anxiety and depression. Being more socially isolated is critically important for, you know, finding ways to help our younger children get that social development that they need for their overall well-being. And so, you know, awareness is certainly a factor for us as healthcare personnel to identify when children may be struggling from increased anxiety or depression. And for parents, they may need to be more creative with finding, you know, safe social opportunities for their children so that they can have that socialization that's critical for development.
When you are watching for those signs of anxiety and depression, how would you suggest that parents talk about COVID-19 with their kids and do it in a non-threatening but still very matter-of-fact way?
Yeah, I think it really is important for parents to talk with their children about it. But one thing that could be frightening for children is if they're getting too much of it by either social media or even TV. Because if you're kind of flooded with this stuff without context, it can be very scary and stressful for children. So I think it's really important for parents to provide context. For example, you know, I think they can share with children that they're at lower risk for suffering from the consequences of the infection itself. But you know, it's also important for parents to provide the context that that they have a role in possible spread, so that they still have to follow rules to help prevent spread to others that might be more likely to have severe disease. So I think parents are really important to provide that context when kids are consuming this information.
I know my kids ask almost every day, Mom, when will this be over? When will this be done with? And, you know, when that is unclear, when there is no timeline, I think that can be so difficult for children to handle.
It is. And it's actually not just difficult for children. I think it's difficult for everyone.
Yeah.
And, you know, even with vaccine development, I want to really make it clear that this is not going to be like an on-off switch where all of a sudden we have vaccine and everything just goes away. If and when vaccine is successfully developed, there's going to be a lot of factors that dictate, you know, how fast we return to more typical or more normal ways, including how effective the vaccine is, what's the acceptance rate of the vaccine, how many doses can be delivered, what's the supply chain like. So there are many, many factors.
What do you mean by the acceptance rate of the vaccine?
So, you know, a lot of people have probably already seen some surveys have looked at when a vaccine's available, will you take the vaccine or not? And it's not as high as I would like it to be, you know, because some people are fearful of the fact that this is being developed quickly. If I could share one major point, I would like people to know that the rapid development of the vaccine is not shortcutting any of the steps that are normally occurring. The reason that it's going so fast is that the government and the pharmaceutical companies, as well as the biotech companies, are dumping billions of dollars into the process so that they can go to the next stage of development before they even know if the prior stage was successful. So what's at risk is financial. They're not shortcutting any of the scientific steps.
We have a Gundersen Health System pediatrician, Raj Naik, fielding questions about kids and the coronavirus, other health issues affecting children. Do your children go to a school that's opening up for in-person classes? What do you want to know about risks? How are you reinforcing behavior and practicing social distancing and mask wearing? What fears has your child expressed to you about the pandemic? And what do you say? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. We'll be back to talk more about COVID and kids after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. A report from the CDC on Friday says children are at risk of developing severe cases of COVID-19. We have a pediatrician fielding your questions about children's health and well-being here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The CDC report analyzed data from 14 states, and it urged public health officials to track pediatric cases and reinforce prevention measures in places where kids gather, like daycare centers and schools. So what questions do you have about how COVID-19 is treated in kids? Are you checking their temp before daycare drop-off? How are you preparing them for school or keeping your teenagers' social and emotional learning going at this difficult time? It's 800-642-1234. Dr. Raj Naik is on the board for the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and he stays with us. Dr. Naik, in this new CDC report, it found Hispanic and Black children in particular were much more likely to require hospitalization for COVID, with Hispanic children about 8 times as likely as white children to be hospitalized. Why is this?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And what we've seen across the country, both adults and now filtering down to the information on children, is that there are communities of predominantly African-American and Latino adults and children that are suffering from more of the consequences. And really what I think the pandemic has shown is that health inequity in general, which is means that, you know, not everybody has the same access or the same advantages and disadvantages of healthcare, is being magnified by the pandemic. So, you know, are there ethnic susceptibilities, or is it related to social factors? We don't necessarily fully understand all of this, but we do know that the effects on people of color are much more significant, and that filters all the way through from adults down to children.
What is the most important thing from your pediatrician standpoint would be steps forward to help, you know, rectify these health inequities? What could we do today to address these inequities?
Yeah, it's obviously a complex series of solutions that need to be put in place. But I think we need to obviously recognize that there are these great health inequities, number one. And then number two, we need to systemically put into place steps to address them. So, you know, if we're not aware of them, if we're ignoring them, we're not going to have any solutions. And then this can't just be on an individual basis. This is where we need cooperation between healthcare centers, communities, schools, governments, to all work together to address these disparities. And I'd love to tell you I have the easy answers for this, but I don't. But I do know that it's going to require a number of steps, including cooperation between all these entities, or it's going to be very difficult to fill in those gaps in healthcare.
Last month, the American Academy of Pediatrics strongly advocated for having students physically present in classrooms as long as the virus isn't surging. What do you think of that?
Yeah, and I think that the statement when it came out from the American Academy of Pediatrics was attempting to highlight the importance of in-person school attendance for children. And they were attempting to give a guide for how it could happen. I don't think that it was intended to say that it should happen regardless of what's going on with the pandemic. So it's been a difficult thing because I don't think most people, when that statement came out, were anticipating the high burden of disease that we have right now as we head into return to school season. And so it was intended to be a guide and to highlight the importance of in-person school attendance for children when it can be done safely, and to try to outline the steps to allow that to occur as safely as possible. Unfortunately, the summer has not gone as we had hoped with regards to the pandemic, increase and the unfortunate transmission of cases throughout many of our states.
You mentioned screen time earlier, and virtual learning, virtual school could mean a lot more screen time. What impact do screens have on kids?
Yeah, there is a lot of concern about that. When we talk about screen time, we're focusing a lot on recreational screen time. Obviously, with what we're dealing with, we have to modify a little bit of our expectations about screen time. But in addition, just to the decreased activity and the amount of time that children are sedentary, which is certainly a big concern, there are other concerns about just screen time in general. And one fact that is interesting and concerning is that there was a look at online child exploitation over a couple month period during this pandemic, and the amount of online child exploitation doubled within that couple month period. So there are those types of concerns too. So I think the message that I would send to parents is that it's critically important to know what your children are doing, know what they're doing online. If they're learning online and spending more screen time because of those learning needs, then it's really important to encourage them to be off of screens for recreational time during the pandemic.
We're talking with Dr. Raj Naik, a pediatrician at Gundersen Health System. He's on the board for the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, taking your health questions and what concerns your child headed into the fall. And you can join in with people avoiding doctor's visits and vaccinations. Are you concerned about an outbreak of vaccine-preventable illnesses? Are you delaying taking your child to the doctor? What is behind that with the COVID risk? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Naik, you know, when you're a parent, it's really difficult to be able to balance that recreation, if you will, with screens, because the screen has, in some respects, without going to camp, the screen is the babysitter in when the parent is trying to do work from home. And, you know, I know in our household, if we say, okay, no screen Sunday, we've already broken that rule by 1 o'clock in the afternoon. How can you help parents through this when screens are really trying to help them so they can do their work?
Yes, this is another really difficult challenge related to the pandemic, because a lot of times parents are trying to work while their children are home and can't spend that actual physical time with supervision. And so there are a few things to think about. It may not be always realistic to say absolutely no screens during this amount of time, but you have to at least be aware of what your children are doing. When you can, maybe give them some specific goals for their activity, and to at least set some limits on the amount of recreational screen time that they're having. And there are some tools you can use, from trackers of their screen time, you know, especially when it's a phone, to having some specific goals written down for them. You know, it's important to try to organize your days and your time in a very specific way to modify at least the amount of time they're spending.
It's funny that, you know, before the pandemic, we were concerned about kids being too structured, having too many activities to go to, and not having much of any downtime. And it's like whiplash now because of all of this unstructured downtime. What do you see from a pediatric standpoint when kids have unstructured time on their hands?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, and I think true. I think it, you know, balance is always the key, having some combination of unstructured time so they can be creative. And I actually have seen, you know, we're focusing on some of the consequences. I will say that when I'm in my neighborhood, I've seen more people out and about and walking and riding bikes. And, you know, I think some families really have focused on spending that time. And some families have spent a lot more time together as a family. So some of the unstructured time is probably good. It's allowed people sometimes to unplug and to focus on their family and their relationships with other creative activities. So again, it's not all bad, and I think there have been some families that have really prioritized these activities that have been good. On the other hand, I have seen some problems with some children. I'll use an example of several of my patients with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, with the online portion of learning that occurred in the spring, really struggled with how to organize their time, and really had some challenges with getting their schoolwork done. And so, you know, in the end, I think there is a balance that we want to strike between structured and unstructured time to give us the best overall outcomes.
Still time to talk with pediatrician Raj Naik from Gunderson Health System. You can join in. What do you want to know about catching up, getting on track with a vaccination schedule? Are you concerned about an outbreak of vaccine-preventable illnesses at your school? Is your kid in front of screens this summer? Are you struggling to get them moving with sports and camp activities not on the calendar? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Dr. Naik here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation now with Gunderson Health System pediatrician Raj Naik. He is our guide to what the medical community knows about how COVID-19 affects kids. In Wisconsin, there have been 2,097 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in children 9 and younger. Dr. Naik, I want to circle back to multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children, MIS-C, and you know, last month, DHS said Wisconsin had 6 confirmed cases. How much of a risk is this to children?
You know, we're still learning about how much of a risk it is. It seems to be pretty uncommon, but obviously when it happens, it's pretty severe consequences. So it's not frequent, but it is severe. The true incidence is hard to determine because there are many children who may be infected with coronavirus that are not being diagnosed, because children in general are at lower risk for severe signs of infection. They may not ever present or get tested. So when we talk about the number of confirmed cases, that could be a very small number related to the overall number of cases. So, you know, how often does this happen? What's the true incidence? It's probably pretty low. But like a lot of things in children, if it's very severe in the consequences, it doesn't mean that it's not important. So I think the key message is we certainly still don't want our children to get infected. There are consequences sometimes that can be severe. And there are some children who have died from coronavirus that have otherwise been healthy without high-risk conditions and didn't have the multi-inflammatory syndrome. So there are some children that just get bad cases that have severe consequences as well.
How do children do in intensive care in the ICU?
So most children that end up in the ICU still fortunately recover from the respiratory components of the virus and are ultimately discharged. The number of deaths in the country due to COVID is relatively low, but as a healthcare provider for children, you know, one is too many in my book. And so, you know, I don't want the message to be that it's necessarily acceptable. It's something that we are working hard to try to prevent any childhood deaths from this infection. But most children who end up in the ICU fortunately recover.
For children who do end up in the ICU, is it similar treatment protocols that you would find for adults who are in the ICU due to COVID?
Yeah, the numbers have been lower, so there's less information. But the treatment is predominantly supportive for everyone. There have been some small trials of therapeutics in adults, you know, for example, with dexamethasone. I'm not an intensive care doctor, but we need the studies in children. Unfortunately, a big point to remember is that the studies in children often lag behind the studies in adults. And so a lot of times, until those studies are done, we're actually making educated guesses. In this case, the treatment is predominantly just supportive and not necessarily therapeutics.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Raj Naik. He's a pediatrician at Gundersen Health System. Dr. Naik, you mentioned there children being asymptomatic. And in those circumstances, when you're seeing children with very, very mild cases and symptoms, how should the adults who are interacting around them, the daycare center providers, the teachers, how do you interact around children if so many are asymptomatic?
Yeah, it's a really important question about whether or not asymptomatic children are a major source of transmission. And the scientific answers for that are not yet fully understood. I will say that there was an early narrative that children don't play much of a role in transmission, but I think there's a lot of information yet to be determined scientifically. There's some experience now as children are returning to school in the Sun Belt in the southern part of the country, as well as some anecdotal and case study information from like overnight camps in Georgia, where it looks like children may play a bigger role than some of the early narrative about it. And so my key message would be, I think people have to take in both schools and daycare settings the best personal precautions that they can, which means hand hygiene and mask wearing. So it all goes down to the same things, along with the physical distancing the best you can. If you're a child care provider, there's only so much distancing you can do. But in the school setting, more of that is possible.
If daycare center workers or teachers are wearing masks, how might that affect the development of very young children who are still learning how to communicate?
Yeah, we don't know the impact yet about how that impacts speech and language development when parents and child care providers may be spending more time in masks. But I share the concern that it's one of these other potential downstream effects that for children that we'll have to learn as we go forward. But I share the concern that infants and young children, they mimic facial expressions and sounds, and they watch the way that parents and caregivers' mouths move, and so it's all part of the potential developmental issues that we'll have to monitor.
Well, certainly everyone is trying to monitor the best they can. There is so much information that is out there, and it seems also like social media can draw different conclusions about treatments and infection rates. How should parents make sense of it all?
Yeah, I think this is a really important point, and I think one that I have been sharing with families as they come to see me is that as information is being played out in the media, social media, and real time for us as scientists, I think that a lot of parents see a headline or one little study presented in a headline and feel like that is the final ruling on all of this. And I think what people are seeing is science playing out in real time. And I think it's really important that people understand how science is done. And the way science is done is we make hypotheses and then we study them. And one or two studies may say one thing and then another study may be something else. But what we're trying to do is build a body of evidence over time. And I tell people it's like a police detective if they were trying to solve a case. One circumstantial clue does not make the whole case. You want to build the body of evidence over time until you prove something beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's the same way that science works. And I think that what people have to know is headlines of the science is playing out in the news. That's not yet necessarily the full body of evidence. We haven't proved things beyond a reasonable doubt yet. And I think some people see that as conflicting evidence when what they're really seeing is just science play out in real time, which is not usually what happens. And so I think they have to trust their healthcare providers to help interpret it. And we have to trust the public health experts to help lead us to the right path. And what I always say is it's okay to be wrong initially. That's what science is based on. But what we have to do is get it right in the end.
Dr. Naik, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Raj Naik is a pediatrician at Gunderson Health System. He's on the board of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Just ahead, it is On Point. Small businesses are struggling, but what communities are hardest hit? Economist Raj Chetty shares his surprising findings and insights. That is On Point. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.